I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We start today with a look at schools. Since last March, students, educators, and families have grappled with how to adjust to the abrupt change to how children learn. Some families participated in online remote learning, while others opted for a hybrid approach, with classes offered online and in person. Parents were tasked with supervising their children's education, in addition to navigating the school reopenings and closures as the number of COVID cases ebbed and flowed. Some students stopped attending classes completely. Other parents grew frustrated with the options being provided and opted to homeschool, hire teachers to instruct learning pods, or pursue independent schools. These alternative approaches to education meant they weren't constrained by the same strict COVID-era regulations that bound public schools. An analysis from Chalkbeat and the AP found that across 33 states, enrollment in public schools fell by more than 500,000 students. Because public schools are funded based on the number of students they serve, this decline will be felt sharply. We're joined now by Mariah Belinget, a reporter covering national education issues for The Washington Post, and Liz Willen, editor-in-chief of the Hechinger Report. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
Liz, let's start with inequality in our schools and how the pandemic has affected that. What research or data do we have on how the racial achievement gap during the past year?
Well, right now, there's a lot that we don't know about learning loss. There's an enormous concern about it, though. And one of the things that we've been focusing on at the Hechinger Report is how to stem that going forward. But we're also really concentrated on the sadness of this year and how most schools were really completely unprepared for both coronavirus and virtual learning. And that involves everything from childcare centers to school facilities to unequal internet. And we see it as part of a massive equity crisis that's been facing U.S. schools. And it's really concerning.
So, Mariah, what role did the types of resources schools had at the start of the pandemic play in how their students have fared?
It has. The disparities that we saw at the start of the pandemic have likely been widened, and we definitely saw a huge difference in the way that affluent districts fared versus districts that did not have very many resources. So in some districts, for example, the kids, we had 4 or 5 hours of live instruction. Kids had laptops. There were no issues with things like internet. And I also spoke to a superintendent in Oklahoma who, in his district, there are so many students without internet that they had to just do paper packets. And at the time, he was talking to me about publishing school lessons in the newspaper. So you see the massive disparities in virtual learning and in remote learning in ways that you might not quite see in the classroom.
So, Liz, back to you. We know there are real benefits to learning in person. So tell us about how both public and independent schools are currently conducting classes.
It's really all over the place across the country. Hmm. But I would echo that this issue of glaring inequality has a lot to do with not only facilities, but also internet access. And the rundown schools, which has caused a lot of more students to go remote. And that's why you ask about private schools. Many of them have much smaller class sizes. They have more up-to-date facilities. So they were able to offer not only in-person experiences, but in many cases that I know of, even offer pop-up campuses in places like the Hamptons, where the wealthy could afford to, who had summer homes there, could stay all year and also could afford tuition, which can be $55,000 a year. And we're talking about even for like middle school. And they were able to do that. They could put together outdoor facilities and come up with teachers with small class sizes and social distancing measures that the public schools with aging facilities couldn't. But in a way, I think that just kind of changes the argument, because you have to be able to afford that. And that's not most of our country. That's a very small segment of our population that is able to do that kind of thing.
And Liz, I wonder if there are students who have actually benefited from remote learning. What do we know about that?
I think that we have found some positive aspects throughout all of this. We're trying to focus on them. It's not easy to find that. It's just that there are some lessons around this, and I think that going forward will be helpful for some parents and for some schools. I think there's much more of a recognition of what individual students need. Mental health issues and social emotional learning are in some ways things that are gone to the top of people's agendas as a result of this. But I think overall, you're finding most students and families so anxious to get back to what they remember about public schools and about classrooms as sort of the rock of their existence.
Mariah, some parents have sought out alternatives to public schooling because of the reopenings and closings associated with the pandemic and remote hybrid in-person learning. What can you tell us about the change in enrollment in private schools or homeschooling or learning pods since the start of the pandemic?
Well, it's really interesting. Parents have sought out, yeah, you're right, a number of alternatives. A lot of parents, or not a lot, but we know of parents, for example, that hired teachers to oversee learning pods. So the students were still enrolled in the public school, but they actually had a teacher overseeing them so that they could get sort of that in-person interaction as well, and also have somebody supervising them. We also know that there is a huge increase in the number of parents homeschooling their children. My colleagues over at EdWeek did a poll at the beginning of the year that suggests that homeschooling has nearly tripled. That is definitely the case in places like Oklahoma. And I did some reporting as well on New Mexico, where they actually had to go looking for students and found out that they were at home being homeschooled, but the parents hadn't registered them. So we do see an enormous increase in the number of students being homeschooled. The other thing that is also happening is that we've seen a huge drop in the number of kids enrolled in pre-kindergarten and kindergarten. And so some parents, a lot more parents these days are quote unquote redshirting their kindergartners. This was something that we used to see mostly among affluent white parents, but it has expanded dramatically, likely from parents who felt like it was not a good idea to put their young child in front of a computer or who were worried about their young child maybe not keeping on a mask on all day. And some of these environments, in-school environments, are really not the same. I was at a school in Brooklyn where the kids cannot play on the playground. They cannot have plush toys. And they, you know, it's a somewhat oppressive environment for some of these kids.
And based on your reporting, Mariah, do you think parents are likely to keep their kids in these alternative forms to public education after the pandemic ends?
Well, I think if there's anything about the pandemic that I've learned is that it's really, really hard to predict anything. Yeah. I certainly think there are some parents who might discover that they prefer the curriculum that they were doing. The other thing that's been interesting about this pandemic is that because of virtual schooling, parents had an unusual amount of access to their child's quote unquote classroom because they can just look over their shoulder. Mm. So some parents discovered that they didn't like what their kids were learning. They didn't like the way that the lessons were presented. They didn't like their way that their children were being treated. So they may opt to continue homeschooling their children. I also think that it also depends on how much patience the parents have. The other thing that parents have learned through this is just how difficult teaching is. That's a sentiment we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, where some people were going on Twitter and saying, we should pay our teachers millions of dollars every year. This is so hard. So I think it's really difficult to say. I suspect that it'll remain up for a few years, but I do suspect that a lot of the parents who are homeschooling this year will be eager to send their kids back to the classroom next year if they feel like it's safe.
Liz, funding for public schools is based on the number of students they serve. How does moving children into alternative forms of education affect the remaining students?
It really hurts. Remember, the public school, even school system in this country, even before the coronavirus, it's a fragile system, and they were still recovering from losses from the 2008 recession and massive layoffs. And as far as we're concerned, if more people stay out of public schools, it's going to just exacerbate this gap between the rich and poor. And that becomes a chasm for parents. But I also want to add a little bit about the pods. Yes, we also found many kindergarten students are missing. No one knows why they didn't show up, but it does make sense because learning online when you're 4 and 5 is not is hardly optimal. But we're also finding that some of these pods, they're just kind of ad hoc, and they're made up of camp counselors and babysitters. And so, yeah, parents are doing them, but out of necessity, not because this is the way they want their children to learn. And the bulk of the parents that we've been interviewing talk about being so desperate to get back into the classroom and also into all the other things that the schools offer. Like I started with, they're the rock, they're the centerpiece of your kids' life. And of for me, when my kids were going through New York City public school system, the centerpiece of our life. Everything about it, from the teachers, the relationships, to the sports, to the after school activities, to the performances, to the publishing parties, it's embedded in your life, your daily life and your family's life. And that's what I think parents and families and students are really missing.
Do you think the pandemic has changed the perception of public schools? Have people started to view them in a different light, Liz?
Totally depends on where you live. I mean, remember right here in New York, you might have a suburban system that's open 5 days a week and the kids are having sports still. And then, you know, last week we ran an op-ed by a high school student at Beacon here in New York City who has not set foot in the classroom all year. He is incensed and very angry at the way the city has handled it. So you have a range of reactions and a range of feelings about how it was handled. And I think a lot of that depends on whether or not you were able to get back into the classroom. Remember, this is a New York City public high school kid who has not yet set foot in the classroom in a year.
And Mariah, the disparities in education go beyond private versus public schools. So what have you found in your reporting when it comes to public schools that were well-equipped to adapt versus public schools that weren't?
Well, certainly the technology made a huge, huge, huge difference. One of the things is that this pandemic has illuminated is how many kids don't have internet. And we're not just talking in rural parts of the country where, you know, you and I might struggle to get a cell signal. This is in Baltimore, in Cleveland, in Chicago. These are in urban places where, or in urban systems where even within the city, there's not good connectivity. So that is one thing that we've certainly learned, and that had a huge impact on whether a kid was able to get a really good online virtual experience versus a pretty inadequate one.
Mariah Balingit is a reporter covering national education issues for The Washington Post. Among the many things that educators and parents will have to decide in the next few months is how they'll attempt to make up the gap for students who missed out on learning consistently throughout the academic school year. So is summer school the right answer, or does that feel cruel for students who spent the last year in educational limbo? I'm still here with Liz Willen, editor-in-chief of the Hechinger Report. Liz, one of your reporters at the Hechinger Report recently published a piece on whether or not summer school is the answer to help students make up for lost school time. So what does research tell us about whether or not summer school would help with improving reading and math levels?
You know, it's so interesting. First thing you said about summer school being cruel. I once spent a couple of months in the summer following one summer school student in New York City. And, you know, the teachers don't want to be there. The kids don't want to be there. So overall, it's always felt sort of punitive. But Jill Barshay, who does our Proof Points column every week and looks at education research, did found something really interesting. Everyone's focusing right now on that summer school is going to, you know, it's common sense, right? It's going to make up for all the months that students lost during the coronavirus time. And everyone is pushing for schools to stay open this summer. Governors, even the teachers union. But there's a problem. The research studies are showing us that summer school often is punitive, doesn't accomplish its purpose of raising reading achievement or math, and they're not necessarily very effective. So it looks like it should help, but we see a lot of mixed research on this and overall a lot of feeling that it isn't beneficial.
And there was $1.2 billion set aside for summer schools in the last COVID relief package. So is there something else that you think schools might need more urgently?
Yeah, researchers are really pointing to something called high dosage tutoring. It's a term that you're going to hear a lot of lately. And that's kind of a different way of approaching it. It's far more individual. It's not like once a week homework help. It's actually using tutors who are specially trained and coached, and they stick to a detailed curriculum. They work with one or two students at a time. These are the kind of results that can occur, you know, either during the ordinary school day, or they're saying, if you're going to do this during the summer, then also make it a little more fun for kids, you know, some pizza parties and some trips and some, a lot of outdoor time. But these kids have been indoors for a year.
Yeah. And I mean, back to that cruel word, I mean, does it feel cruel to expect kids to spend the summer learning via Zoom or even in person after this incredibly difficult year of learning?
Zoom, impossible. I really don't think you're going to get any kid in the slightest bit excited about spending more time on Zoom or any more parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, in person, I think there are ways it can be done with this high dosage tutoring, with a different approach, with more outdoor time. If all of the vaccines are really happening, as we're hearing in the next couple of weeks and days, it should be a completely different situation by the time summer comes around. But it also is super important to look at the research, that a lot of efforts, a lot of the research is showing initial gains that you get from extra summer school instruction are going to disappear by the next spring. And that's not small research. It's conducted in five cities, Boston, Dallas, Jacksonville, Florida, Pittsburgh, and Rochester, by researchers at RAND. And I think that's important to look at that, because in this study, 20% of kids never even showed up for summer school. And the kids who did come skipped an average of one out of every 4 days. Other kids skipped more, and there were only a fraction of benefits seen from students who attended faithfully even for two summers in a row. So what they did find, though, that I think is really interesting and instructive and might help us this summer going forward, is that programs that resembled camp and had sports and arts, even though they didn't have any better attendance, but if you gave parents prizes for families, like supermarket gift cards and treats for kids, pizza and ice cream, all of those things helped. And I think the outdoor programs and times definitely make it more palatable to kids if you add in the high dosage tutoring.
And what about the process of holding students back to repeat a year? Is that being proposed as a viable solution to make up for the gaps?
That hasn't been discussed in a widespread way yet. And I think a part of it goes to the first question that you asked me that I really couldn't answer yet. Mm-hmm. What does the research show us about learning loss this year? It's not yet clear what kind of testing there will be and how teachers are going to measure student progress, especially since a lot of them didn't show up. And think about it, a lot of student progress also is based on the relationship teachers form with their students. And, you know, I'll bring you back to the example of the student sitting in his bedroom for a year. You know, he's never even met any of his teachers this year. So a lot of the progress and the relationships that the teachers find and how they speak in class and the time that you spend with them, all of that plays into how well a student is performing and how they're evaluated. I think it's going to be really difficult to get a full picture of what kind of learning loss happened among students. And again, lots of students didn't even show up. There's many, many students missing in districts all over the country.
Now, Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, has actually voiced her support for summer schools. So what do you think is the perceived benefit there?
Well, I think, again, it's a big concern over how much students lost and a mm-hmm. desire to get them back in person and get them in classrooms and get people feeling get of a more normal sense of what school was like and can be like, and they can get fun again. And I think there are a lot of questions about how they can do that successfully and also help kids catch up. But I do think they should take a look at the research, because it's concerning, mm-hmm. and make sure that anything that does take place is not on Zoom. No more Zoom, no more online. Get the kids back in school is the sense that I think you can hear overwhelmingly from parents, and I think teachers as well, ultimately.
Yeah, so in the last 20 seconds, where do you think school districts and educators should begin when it comes to making up for the gaps of the last year or so?
Look at the research, listen to parents, and really think about how to make this work. It's been difficult. It's a tough time for everyone, but public schools matter desperately in our democracy, and how to make them work and get the kids back and the teachers teaching again and learning and feeling enthusiastic about it is essential.
Liz Willen is the editor-in-chief of the Hechinger Report. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina today. The push to decriminalize and now legalize marijuana in New York has been a long journey, and one that advocates are hopeful will begin to reverse decades of racial inequity. Marijuana arrests have had a disproportionate impact on communities of color in New York and across the country. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, in New York State, in the first half of 2019, Black and Latinx people accounted for 75% of people arrested for low-level marijuana possession. That's despite being only 33% of the state's population. For more on New York's approach to legalization, we're joined by Melissa Moore, New York State Director for the Drug Policy Alliance. Melissa, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So the bill to legalize marijuana in New York State has been a long time in the making. Can you tell us how the state evolved in its stance on drugs, drug laws, and sentencing since the 1970s?
This has been a long journey. So in the 1970s in New York, we see the Rockefeller drug laws, which were some of the most draconian approaches to policymaking around drugs that had existed anywhere in the country. And the toll was immediate and devastating in communities of color and low-income communities, but really all pockets of New York State. So pretty swiftly, we see this effort around especially decriminalization of low-level marijuana possession, because so much of the enforcement was targeting young people. We see this effort to decriminalize low-level possession. Unfortunately, there was a loophole within that that allowed for ongoing misdemeanor arrests if somebody's possession was considered to be in public view. And initially, that didn't have a huge impact. But then we get into the era of stop and frisk policing, broken windows policing, and those arrests skyrocket because suddenly officers are telling people to empty their pockets and are getting marijuana in public view and making an arrest from that unconstitutional stop. And so at that point, we see arrests go above 50,000 a year just in New York City alone. So there was a further effort around decriminalization that began in the early 2010s, built further and further to 2019, when unfortunately the state didn't pass full adult use for marijuana, but did pass a further effort around decriminalization and also established expungement for the first time, which was really important because up to that point, we had seen 800,000 arrests for low-level marijuana possession just in 25-year period. So as we're moving forward to this moment, you know, it's really a reckoning of so many policies from the 1970s and even prior to that, that were really just rooted in stigma and had nothing to do with the plant itself and yet had devastating impacts across our state.
So what does the rollout of this bill, of this plan, look like?
So the bill will cover all aspects of the cannabis plant in New York. It will have a supervisory structure for adult use cannabis, as well as bringing the medical marijuana program and the hemp CBD farming program all under the umbrella of the same organization. So it'll establish the Office of Cannabis Management, as well as a cannabis control board in New York State. But I think the key details around this bill are really how it's framed in terms of social equity and community reinvestment and restitution. You know, really acknowledging the harms that have been done under prohibition and criminalization, and saying we're not just going to turn the page and say, oh, sorry, you know, and act as if the entire history of harm in communities that was so targeted didn't happen. We have to actually acknowledge that, atone for that, and then provide restitution. And so this bill will devote a significant portion of the tax revenue to reinvestment in communities that were directly harmed by the marijuana arrest crusade and the war on drugs in New York, for things that are responsive to the types of damage that has been done in communities.
Melissa, the Drug Policy Alliance and the Public Science Project at the Graduate Center CUNY released a report 2 weeks ago titled Inequitable Marijuana Criminalization, COVID-19 and Socioeconomic Disparities. Walk us through some of the key findings in that report.
You know, for quite a while now, since the beginning of the pandemic, we've been looking at the disparities and how COVID was impacting different communities. And there's been a lot of really important reporting around that. And we looked at it and realized there were so many overlaps between what we had seen for decades in terms of the racial disparities and biased enforcement around marijuana prohibition. So we actually crunched the numbers along with Public Science Project and found that what we thought to be true anecdotally is actually the case when we have the hard data in front of us, that there are extreme racial disparities in marijuana enforcement. We know that it's still the case in 2020, even during the pandemic, even after decriminalization in New York City. We still have an instance where 94% of the arrests for low-level cannabis were Black and Latinx New Yorkers. And this is despite the fact that people use at similar rates. It's simply a matter of targeted enforcement. And then we looked at the economic vulnerability indicators, the proportion of people within a community. We actually analyzed it by zip code, who are experiencing food insecurity and accessing SNAP benefits, for example, or other indicators of poverty, and found that, again, there's a correlation where the communities that are the most impacted by marijuana arrests also have some of the most economic vulnerability. And then we layered the COVID data in on top of that and found that the same communities also have higher COVID positivity rates. And so it's a matter of looking at how these are structural factors that are completely intertwined. It's the same dynamics at play over and over again that are just hitting communities with wave after wave of devastation. And so as we're talking about rebuilding from the COVID crisis, as well as looking at what it is to provide restitution to the communities that were the most harmed by the marijuana arrest crusade, that's really where the conversation around how do we direct the tax revenue from cannabis legalization in New York back into these communities and make sure that there actually is, that there are resources that are going to provide for addressing the incredible harms that were done.
Yeah. And in terms of addressing that racial inequity, how does what New York is doing or trying to do differ from what other states have already done?
You know, I think this bill is the most ambitious in the country in terms of social equity. And it also has distinct streams in terms of social equity, which is really pertaining to the industry and the business portion of cannabis legalization and adult use. And then there's the community reinvestment part, which we've talked about. And that will create a community grants reinvestment fund that will have revenue available for entities that are working in communities that have been directly harmed with people who have been directly impacted to be able to access those funds. But on the social equity side, you know, this bill is really rooted in not just doing this as business as usual in New York. And I think that's really important given that we're the financial heart of the country. This bill really centers cooperatives, micro businesses, ways for people to bridge from the legacy market into the regulated space. And I think that's so crucial. And this is part of the fabric of this bill, you know, really to its core, is making sure that there will be opportunities for small businesses, for family farmers, for people all across the state who don't necessarily have access to huge amounts of capital. So New York was able, through the hard work of the bill co-sponsors, the majority leader, Crystal Peoples Stokes, and Senator Liz Krueger, they really fought for this provision and they fought for the community reinvestment, knowing that this was so much also about justice and making sure that we were going to set up the cannabis economy in New York in a way that would actually benefit, you know, small businesses and New Yorkers who have been directly impacted by prohibition. And I think that's actually like really a watershed moment for New York.
Melissa Moore is New York State Director for the Drug Policy Alliance. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last week, Brazil became just the second country in the world after the United States to pass 300,000 deaths from COVID-19. The country has also seen record-high daily death totals in recent weeks, and many of Brazil's hospitals are experiencing ICU shortages. At the same time, the country's vaccination rollout has been slow. Around 6.5% of the Brazilian population has received one vaccination dose so far. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has frequently cast doubt on the effectiveness of the vaccines and has not pursued vaccine purchases as aggressively as other world leaders. And the emergence this year of a COVID variant that has spread from Brazil to other parts of the world means that outbreaks within the country could also hamper efforts to contain COVID-19 globally. Here with us now is Ernesto Londoño, Brazil Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Welcome back to the show, Ernesto.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we mentioned the high death totals Brazil has experienced in recent weeks. How does this moment compare to other points in the pandemic for Brazil?
This is definitely the worst crisis we've seen in over a year of the pandemic here in Brazil. There was a period of crisis last year when much of the world went into lockdown, but the hospitals, for the most part, were able to cope with the volume of patients they were getting. What we've seen in recent weeks, though, is very different. We're seeing a systemic breakdown of the healthcare system across the country, several states where ICU units are at capacity or overflowing. You know, what this means, practically speaking, is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who need critical care who just simply aren't getting it. And that means people are dying because they can't get the kind of care they need in hospitals.
How much are COVID variants contributing to this current outbreak?
I think there's a growing consensus that this latest surge has been powered by the variants in Brazil. You know, primarily the P1 variant, which scientists believe is far more contagious than the virus we experienced last year. So, you know, they're saying that on the one hand, more people are getting exposed to the virus because these new variants are simply easier to catch. And another thing they're seeing, which is new, is more young people becoming gravely ill. And what this means when they reach the hospitals is that because they are younger and their bodies are more resilient, they spend more time in the hospital, which means that the turnover of beds becomes slower. So I think that's part of the reason that the hospital system is struggling to cope with a caseload right now.
Ernesto, in the U.S., communities of color have been hit disproportionately hard by COVID-19. How have Brazil's Black and Indigenous communities been impacted by the virus?
The research I've seen so far also suggests that Black Brazilians have borne a disproportionate brunt of this virus. That by virtue of the kind of jobs many of them have, you know, the fact that many of them work in service industries, or many of them don't have the luxury to work at home, don't have jobs that allow them to just stay at home and work from home, means that they are increasingly exposed, that they are more reliant on public transportation, that they have public-facing jobs in the service industry. So many of them are becoming sick. I have not seen comprehensive statistics that give us a very clear breakdown, but the data I've seen does suggest that they are disproportionately exposed. Indigenous communities were among the priority groups in Brazil's vaccine rollout, but unfortunately, we've seen that many have been reluctant to take the vaccine. Many are reluctant to sort of believe and accept medical interventions from people that come from the outside because there's a long history of distrust. A decent share of the indigenous population living in remote communities have been inoculated already. There have been significant problems in rolling out these vaccines to these remote areas quickly and getting the target population to sort of believe that these vaccines are effective and necessary.
And how has President Jair Bolsonaro responded to this current wave of cases and deaths?
I think there's been a little bit of a shift in his posture. You know, this is a world leader who was extremely cavalier, you know, for the past year, who questioned science, who questioned the severity of this disease, and who, you know, sabotaged efforts to in post lockdowns to promote mask wearing, to promote social distancing. And even, you know, when it came to vaccines, he sort of fueled these ideas that these vaccines were not to be trusted right away. He even joked at one point that, people who took the vaccine might turn into alligators, and that the pharmaceutical companies would not be held responsible. I think as the death toll has climbed, and as, you know, mayors and governors around the country are crying for help and pleading for international aid, I think it's dawned on him that he has a very big problem on his hands. Yesterday, he sacked six of his ministers, so there's been a cabinet reshuffle. Mm-hmm. In recent days, he let go of his health minister, who was widely viewed as ineffective. And the president has started, you know, promoting the use of vaccines and saying that, you know, that the government is working very hard to make up for lost time and to procure more vaccine supplies. But it's been a very slow process, and the rollout has been very slow. And the main reason for that is that the Brazilian government just did not act with a sense of urgency while many other countries were getting in line and, locking in access to the first waves of vaccine supplies.
Former President Trump had a friendly relationship with Bolsonaro. So what has communications looked like between the Biden administration and Bolsonaro's government so far?
So far, I think they look pretty frosty. It's unclear what might be happening behind the scenes. You know, the Brazilian government has said that it's interested in getting any surplus vaccines the U.S. may have available. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really seen efforts at the highest level to reset this relationship and to see if there are areas of mutual cooperation, not just on healthcare, but in other areas like the environment.
Ernesto Londoño is a Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times. Ernesto, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all we have for you folks today. It's always a pleasure sitting in for Tanzina and being with you. We appreciate hearing your voice on the show, so continue to call us about any ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also find me on Twitter at Rebe Ibarra C. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, and this is The Takeaway. We'll be back with more tomorrow.